you would stand up and help me welcome my friend, fellow Aggie, Texas Governor Rick Perry.
Thank you. Thank you. Mayberry, USA. He is all American right there. Thank you, Warren. I appreciate you coming and being here. John, thank you for allowing us to come, and to all of you that are involved with Feeding the World. God bless you, and thank you all for what you do. As we walk through the facility today and we had the opportunity to just take a peek at what you're doing, well, not everything you're doing, but what they would show me, the highly technical classified things they couldn't show me, but it brought back into my memory the times that I didn't grow up in corn country. But I grew up in cotton and wheat and sorghum country. And working with the, I was just sharing with them that my dad and I were in the late 70s and the early 80s were involved with the Foundation Seed Program growing wheat with our beloved Texas A&M, was some great researchers and had some wonderful programs from the standpoint of developing, doing exactly what you're doing today. Trying to find those strains, trying to find those genetic traits that allow for these crops to be grown in places where 15 years ago they wouldn't grow. Well, they wouldn't grow and they wouldn't produce, but to be able to have that productivity, to be able to have that drought resistance characteristics and what you all are doing on that side, and how important that is to the world. Doc and I were kind of discussing, that find that thing in life that drives you, that makes your life be consequential. And I can't think of many things in this world. When you think about people's quality of life, when you think about how the world is going to be, I think, approaching 9 billion people by 2050. And the pressure that's on you to find that that food supply, to be able to find those crops that are going to be able to be grown in maybe the Eastern European countries or in Africa or in some of the other parts of the world where food is truly that limiting factor. So what you're doing today and the things that pioneer is about today, 20, 30 years down the road, people will look back and say that there were some folks in Iowa that made a huge difference. I had the opportunity to get to know Norman Borlaug. Norman was a Nobel winner in the wheat side of things. He was credited with the Green Revolution. And doing someone in this audience maybe about to make a discovery that has the same impact on the world that Norman Borlaug did in his day. To be consequential is why I think most of you are here. To be working with a company that is committed to being consequential. And that's really what America should be and historically has been all about, being consequential in the world. And on the agricultural side, all too often people think about agriculture and they sometimes they miss the importance of what we do. And I can say we, since I still have that those roots that run deep in that little place called Paint Creek, Texas. Now, just to fill those of you in who haven't been exposed to that story, Paint Creek was about 16 miles from the closest place that had a post office. It was rural. It was a little school out on a Farnham Market Road and had a Baptist church and a Methodist church across the road, your choice, and about 100 and as I recall, about 110 kids, grades 1 through 12. I did graduate in the top 10 in my class. That's very good. I think there were 13, so I had a chance. But then it was off to Texas A&M University to be a veterinarian. Not unlike you, I had my eyes set on that side of and organic chemistry actually is what made a pilot out of me. So I had a little career change into my sophomore year, my degree was in animal science, and then went off and flew in the Air Force for about 4.5 years, and I got to see how the rest of the world lived, and I got to see a lot of different countries, and I got to see a lot of different people and governments and how those people were impacted. In the northern part of Africa, in 1975, living in Saudi Arabia, as they were making that transition from a Bedouin Indian type of a existence to the country, starting on to the country that it is today, and in Europe and South America and Central America. And it was just a fascinating experience for me, for someone who had looked at the world through a pinhole for a long time, and to have gone from a pedestrian speed to literally Mach 1.2 and to really see this world that we live in. And all too often, in this fast-paced world and this effort to find the next big thing, agriculture gets overlooked, and it shouldn't. Because I will suggest to you at the end of the day, that phrase that we hear often, if we don't get this right now, the quality of life for people is going to be substantially poor. But this quality of life for people can be rather fine, rather grand, if we are able to develop these processes and these research experiences that turn into great things for our fellow man. And that's what I wanted to come and share with you today, is thank you for what you do. As we talk about, you know, why are you running for the presidency of the United States? And I share people that I got a great job. Being the governor of Texas is a great job. I tell Terry Branstad on a regular basis how good a job it is, and that we compete against each other. And you see, that's what I want America again to be, this place where competition is what we hang our hat on, and giving you the freedom to compete. All too often, from a regulatory standpoint, our friends in Washington, D.C., and I'm the first to tell people, I'm not a big fan of Washington, D.C. I think they need to do a few things and do those few things really well, but I don't think they have the intellectual firepower to decide how one size can fit all of these different 50 laboratories of innovation that are out here called states. And that these states should compete against each other, just as I'm pretty sure Iowa State and Iowa are going to compete with each other. I think they already did that this year, didn't they? So sorry to bring that up for you Iowa folks. And the Aggies and the Longhorns are going to have this competition, right? We hope. but competition all too often gets stunted by a federal government that tries to put in place one-size-fits-all regulations. And I think if there's one thing I can leave you with today that I'm passionate about, is to free up our private sector, and for that matter, the public sector, from the overreaching, overburdensome regulations that all too often we see come out of Washington. And I give you all are in the process of making a decision about expanding Pioneer's footprint right here. And you're doing it not in a small way. And the EPA is going to have regulations that you have to put a fine pencil to decide whether or not we're going to be this size or we're going to be this size because of the cost of those regulations. And my question for those agencies is this. Are those regulations that you're putting forward actually going to be beneficial to the point that the cost of them balances out? And if not, then why are we doing it? And so across the energy industry side, of which you're partly involved with, that's one of the things that I've laid out and said that we as a country need to have a very serious conversation about energy production in America. I happen to be an all of the above energy person, whether it's solar or whether it's wind or whether it's ethanol or whether it's any of the biofuels, the alternative fuels, or natural gas or coal or nuclear. I happen to think that all of those can be developed safely and appropriately with the right protections for the people of this country and our environment, that it can be done. And it can be done without strangling the economics. I happen to believe that the federal government needs to not be picking winners and losers. They need to be allowing companies like Pioneer to get R&D credits so that you know that you can be out there putting that research and that development into place to find the newest next big thing. But I don't believe that the federal government ought to be choosing Pioneer or some other company, or for that matter, some other industry sector, and saying, this is where we're going to put our eggs. I think the marketplace will find that we're going to need all of it. As we were talking about the different types of cellulose and the new types of energy that are being developed. Research and development, innovation. 15 years ago, people were making pretty good livings going around the country giving the speech that we're through with fossil fuels in America. Remember, I mean, no more fossil fuels. We've found it all. We've discovered it all. We're going to find something else. But innovation has allowed us to find new forms of energy in a lot of different places. I mean, the idea that the Marcellus Shale and this just incredible amount of natural gas and our ability through innovation and technology to find the ways to hydraulically fracture and open up those formations. I mean, it's fascinating how people like you, scientists, researchers, innovators, when they're given the freedom, when they're given the incentive, that's what America is supposed to be about. And giving America the freedom to innovate and to find the solutions to the challenges that face this world is what we ought to be focused on in Washington, D.C. And so if I leave you with one thing, it is as I am a believer in freedom. Freedom from overtaxation and freedom from overregulation and freedom to allow this country to really be the leader, whether it's in the food supply, the energy supply, are in one thing that I think the world needs a huge supply of, and that's freedom. So thank you for letting me come, and I think we're going to open it up for some questions, John.
Yeah. We'll open it up for questions now. So if you want to ask your question, certainly raise your hand. We'll pick you. And when you ask your question, tell the governor who you are and where in Pioneer that you work, right? What you do at Pioneer. Okay? Anybody want to start off? Courtney?
Courtney's got a question for you.
Oh, yes, ma'am.
Sorry.
My name's Courtney Chabot-Dreyer, and I work in our industry relations group here at Pioneer. I've been here for about 10 years. So my question for you is, recently President Obama announced that he was going to pull back all the troops, and what that does is bring a great deal of hope and expectations for all those loved ones back here who are waiting for their relatives to come back. It also gives a lot of information to those countries that we are at war with. So I'm wondering, as Commander-in-Chief, how are you going to manage our armed forces? What is your, I mean, obviously you served in the Air Force, so you have a strong affinity for the armed forces. So talk a little bit about what your role as Commander-in-Chief is, how you see that.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you. And you're correct. I'm a multi-generational. I think one of the reasons that I served was my father was a B-17 tail gunner during World War II and lived in East Anglia and flew 35 missions over Nazi-held Germany. And so serving my country was a very normal and expected and honorable thing to do. And at the end of the Vietnam conflict, I made that decision to volunteer to serve and to fly in the United States Air Force from 1972 through 77. And that does and still has a very profound impact on me. But even more so is the last 10 years plus, I've been the Commander-in-Chief of the Texas National Guard. Some 20-plus thousand young men and women who serve our state but are on loan to the United States government very often as they deploy to the theaters of conflict now in Afghanistan and Iraq. And so multiple times I have gone over to see them, to thank them, to just be with them in those theaters of operation. So I think every American, I mean, I don't know any American, not even those young men and women who have trained all of their lives to protect our country's freedoms and to defend against those who would try to take freedoms away from or to deliver freedom to people and places where our troops are. And it's not just in those areas of conflict. I mean, we have troops all over the globe that are serving in some form or fashion. They've been in South Korea since the mid-50s. We've been in Germany since right after World War II. So, I mean, America has this long history of having our troops in various and sundry places. I think the question you ask is about from those areas of conflict where there is armed conflict going on. And all of us would like to see them come home as soon and as safe as we can. I mean, nothing would make me happier than to live in a world where Americans were not in harm's way. But unfortunately, that's probably not going to be the case in the world we live in today. I govern a state with a 1,200-mile border with a foreign country that in places you would not know it is not a war zone, where 45,000 Mexicans have been killed by the drug cartels directly attributable to these drug wars that are going on. So, I mean, right in our backyard, if you will, right in our front door with our number one trading partner, Texas and Mexico, we have these conflicts that are ongoing. The issue I have is not with the president's proclamation that he wants to bring our young men and women home. I agree with him. I want to bring them home too. But to signal to your enemy when you're going to bring your troops home is a tactical error, and I think irresponsible from the standpoint of the commander-in-chief signaling for whatever reason. And I won't try to read his mind, but never do you give tactical information to the enemy that you're going to be freeing up a particular part of the world at a particular time. Yes, ma'am.
We have a question from the overflow room from Wesley Nye in our supply planning group. What separates you from the other Republican candidates?
Wow, how much time do we have? No, I'll try to be brief. I think Americans are looking for a chief executive officer who's got experience from the standpoint of executive governance. When you look at what a president does, it is about it's running a really big entity. And I happen to have had the privilege and the great learning process, if you will, for the last 10 plus years of being the CEO of the 13th largest economy in the world. Texas is a very, very large, shares an international border, as we talked about, the number one exporting state in the nation, the best state in the nation to do business. Tell Terry I said that. Actually, Site Selector magazine, I think, just today, picked Texas as the number one state to do business. And so if the issue becomes, I mean, I'll get asked 1,000 questions 100 different ways during the course of a campaign, and there are a lot of different issues. Some of you may have one issue that you will decide who you're going to vote for on, and I totally respect you for that. But let me just say that I think from the vast majority of the people in this country are looking for someone who has the experience and who has the philosophical understanding that the most powerful thing that happens in America and actually happens for this world is that America again becomes a strong economic power. And the way that you become a strong economic power is not by printing more money or by handing out government money and saying that that's going to create jobs. You do it by lowering the disincentives to those of you in the private sector who are the job creators. That's how it happens. It's small mom and pop businesses in Des Moines. It's a small business in Sioux City that today doesn't know whether they can get a loan because of a Dodd-Frank banking regulation that's strangling the community banks in their community. It is a president who understands instinctively and who has had the experience that you free up the private sector, the entrepreneur, and have the confidence that they can risk their capital and have a return on their investment. That's what America, I think, needs, and I think that's what America wants in their next president. Because you can't, if you do not first have, Warren, a strong economy, you can't have a strong military. You're not going to have the dollars to have the research and development on the military side to keep ahead of a very aggressive China. You're not going to be able to assist your allies in Taiwan or India or in South Korea, in Israel, if you don't first have that strong economy. So I think the real difference between myself and those individuals who are standing on the stage with me who would like to be the nominee as well, and in particular in contrast to the current president of the United States, is that for a decade, I have been dealing with these issues. I've been having to make appointments to places like our Natural Resources Agency, our EPA, if you will, to agencies that were making decisions, whether it was the Board of Regents at schools like Texas A&M, who were putting into place the research and the development and investing in with the philosophy of understanding this. It's not the government that creates jobs. It's the private sector that creates jobs. And I think that single very large difference between myself and anyone else on that stage is that for a decade, I have run and successfully state that's created more jobs than any other state in the nation, that for 9 years in a row, Chief Executive Magazine chose Texas as the best state in the nation to do business. And it didn't happen just because we got great country music and barbecue down there. It happened because we've created an environment. Government didn't do it, but we helped create the environment where entrepreneurs knew they could risk their capital and have a return on their investment.
Next question. Yes, right here.
My name is David Habia. I'm from I'm a quantitative geneticist and originally from Germany, actually. What worries me in this country is the social peace between the different social groups. And I think a big factor is the unemployed, the high number of unemployed. And from my understanding is that many of those unemployed have a low education. So, and this is not only in this country the fact, it's also in European countries. So what types of jobs can you provide them? How do you want to create those jobs? Because in the past they were outsourced to other countries. How do you want to bring those back? And if you can't create them, if you reduce the social care programs, how do you keep social peace in this country?
I want to talk from the perspective of what I've been involved with for the last 10 plus years in Texas, and that is developing a workforce that is attractive to companies like Pioneer, companies like Caterpillar, companies like eBay, Facebook, Toyota, that require high-skilled workers in their workforce. And the reason I mentioned those last four companies is all of those have moved part of their manufacturing facilities to the state of Texas over the last 10 years. And there's obviously been substantially more than that, but those are just some high profile ones that in the last few years have moved from one state to another. They've moved not necessarily because of the workforce issue. I think that may be a part of it. They've moved because they found an economic climate that they were more comfortable with. But they would not have come if they did not feel comfortable that the workforce was going to be available that could fill the high-tech jobs at a engine manufacturing facility like Caterpillar, for instance. And the way that we as a country, and we're falling behind. I mean, when every one of the studies that you look at of those countries that are the 30 countries of most developed, if you will, we're falling farther and farther behind in math and in sciences. So the states, not the federal government, it is not the federal government's business. As a matter of fact, the federal government would be abject failures, I would suggest to you, if they decide how you educate your children in Iowa or in Texas or in any other state. I don't think the federal government's business should be about directing states on how to educate their children. I think that is a state issue. And again, those states that understand how important it is to have the skilled workforce will put into place, because of the pressure from their citizens, those programs, science, technology, engineering, math, those STEM, that will make their states be more competitive. But if we rely upon the federal government, and whether it was the Race to the Top or whether it was the program called No Child Left Behind, I am not a supporter of Washington, D.C. making education decisions for the states. I think the states will make the right decisions that best fit their needs in their state, and to make their states be more competitive. And those states that do not, there will be changes at the highest. The governors and the legislators will be removed, and they will put people in that will make their states more competitive. That's how our founding fathers saw this. Here's the other end of the question that you ask: how are we going to get these companies to relocate back into the United States? They did not leave to begin with just because they could find cheap labor somewhere. That may have been part of a formula, but it's not the reason they left. I will suggest to you they left because they were overregulated, and the cost of that regulation and the tax structure that we had in place in this country is what drove the masses away from the manufacturing and the jobs that have moved offshore. I would argue that with just about anyone, that that's the reason people left. They didn't go to India, or they didn't go to China because of the quality of life. They went because they were overregulated and overtaxed. And that's the reason I laid out a 20% flat tax on the personal side. I laid out a 20% corporate tax rate. And there's $1.7 trillion there or about that's offshore. You all have, my bet is you all have money offshore. With Pioneer's got some money offshore. And they're not going to bring it back if you have to pay 35% tax on it. And I laid out a plan that basically said that those companies, U.S.-based companies that have paid their taxes over in the country that they're developing, can bring that money back in for a one-year period of time at 5.25% tax. Chamber of Commerce, American Chamber, says that it would create 3.5 million jobs if that money comes back in, and $360 billion of economic activity. I mean, what are we thinking? That we leave those types of impediments to job creation. You talked about in your early part of your question about all of these people who are unemployed. The best social program ever devised was a job. And that's what America needs to be focused on. That's what the next president needs to be focused on, is how do we create an environment in this country where men and women who are sitting around the coffee table at home today, anxious because they don't have a job, who's going to give them the hope and the confidence that that's going to happen? I'll suggest to you that the person that can do that is sitting in this room with you.
Thanks. We have time for one more question. Anybody else want to do the final question? Okay, there's one back.
Let's take them both, and I'll be quick, and I won't take forever to answer it.
Hi, I'm Ryan Veach. I work in the Safety and Risk Management Department. Just a question on your tax changes. Could you clarify why you would have a flat tax and then you would keep the current code?
The reason that I would have you to have that choice is because there are some companies, and again, I don't know, you know, we might get your CFO up here and give the full reasoning, that they may want to stay in the old system because they may have made substantial plans on the old tax system and to pull that away from them. My instinct is, and most economists that we worked with, and you know, Steve Forbes and David Malpass and Mick Mulvaney, a congressman from South Carolina, worked with us really close amongst some other folks as we developed this plan. But to give people a choice, I mean, would you rather have that and you take off your mortgage deduction, your charitable deductions, your local sales tax or local taxes deduction, and 20%, and send it in on that postcard? That's it. Or if you want to stay with the lawyers and stay with the accountants and spend almost $400 billion a year in preparation cost for the old system. But there may be some folks that want to leave that old system into place. So that's the answer, the reason we left it there, to give people the choice. My instinct is most people are going to go right here. And when they do that, you substantively and forever change the IRS. Yes, ma'am.
I work in human resources. My question is, in the absence of federal regulations, what will you do to stop stupid CEOs of financial institutions from making bad decisions that cause them to fail?
Well, we have plenty of regulations in place to do that. We have to have a government that will actually institute the oversight. All of these, I will tell you, Dodd-Frank and that banking regulation that came into place after the Wall Street debacle was a knee-jerk reaction by Washington, D.C. that actually has put us in substantially worse position than we were before. It institutionalized what they were trying to keep from happening in the federal government to bail out. I would never have bailed anybody out. When you make really bad decisions,
If you are too big to fail, you are too big. And I don't care whether you're a country or whether you're a corporation or whether you're a small business down on Main Street. And there sure weren't, I sure haven't seen any small businesses being bailed out by government. So my point is there are plenty of regulations for whether it's Wall Streeters or whether it's corporate CEOs or whoever it is, for individuals who are breaking the laws of this country, there are plenty of statutes to protect the public from those kinds of individuals. But you have to have a government that is committed to doing that type of work, and that's what we haven't had. I happen to think Wall Street and Washington, D.C. have been in bed together way too long. That's one of the problems that we have in this country, is that there are people who have too much money invested that end up in Washington, D.C. One of the reasons that the establishment really doesn't like me and really doesn't like my tax plan is because they know that I'm going to show up in Washington, D.C. with a sledgehammer, and they're not going to like it. And that's exactly what I think this country needs in Washington, is somebody that's not afraid to go in and to really crush that system that is in place that has cost this country trillions of dollars. And let me just leave you with this as I say thank you to a great company that has the potential to change the world. And every one of you can leave work every day knowing that what you are doing is consequential. And let me leave you with this last question. Are you better off today than you were $4 trillion ago?
Thank you very much, Governor.